place.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Elston. I'm here on behalf of the United States Postal Service today. With me at council table is Andy German, Managing Counsel for Legal Strategy for the Postal Service. I'm going to start by quoting the Postal Regulatory Commission in an order that it entered on September 14, 2010. It stated that unless a particular pricing decision violates one of, quote, three objective, quantitative, and mandatory pricing constraints that constitute clear out-of-bounds lines that the Commission must enforce, the PAEA, the Postal Reform Act of 2006, considerably narrows the PRC's role in reviewing the pricing of postal services. The Postal Service is here today asking this Court to take the PRC at its word and confine the PRC to its proper role in the rate-making scheme that Congress adopted in 2006 in the PAEA.
If we disagree with you and think that PRC has a role enforcing 101D, is that not a legitimate reason? I mean, the quote that you read seems to be the basis for an argument that maybe 101D isn't something that be considered. Are you making that argument?
I'm not saying that it's not something that should be considered in the general work of the PRC in crafting the rate-making scheme. But 101D is a general policy statement that's given effect by Congress through the specific rate-making machinery that adopted in Chapter 36, later in the same title. That's how the prior Postal Rate Commission interpreted it as well. It doesn't provide any specific standards or guidance or guidelines. It's a general policy statement. And it seems...
fair and equitable.
Are you giving it any function at all?
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't be necessary for that purpose, right?
Well, Your Honors, I think that the concept of a fair and equitable pricing is something that is a general policy statement.
Right.
When Congress adopted the PAEA, it adopted a different standard specifically, and that is a just and reasonable rate schedule. What the PRC has done here is it's sort of conflated the specific requirements of Chapter 36 and suggested that if you are in compliance with all of the specific requirements of Chapter 36 and its regulations, you can still nonetheless have a price that's not fair and equitable.
But I'm asking you for your position on the role of 101D.
101D is a general policy statement that can't be specifically enforced, certainly in the ACD context, in the context of an annual compliance determination. I'm not sure that it imposes any standards that are enforceable against the Postal Service. The concept of...
I don't think the canons are very enlightening most of the time, but there is a strong canon requiring that we try to find some function for every phrase Congress uses.
I understand, Your Honor. I think that the function of 101D is to make sure that the costs of the postal operations are apportioned on a fair and equitable basis among all the users of the mail. And that
I thought you just said the specifics of Chapter 36 cover all that.
The specifics of Chapter 36 implement and give definition to that requirement.
So you're saying that's a safe harbor against any 101D claim?
I'm not sure that I can imagine. I'm certain that there could be a situation where something would be deemed not fair and equitable with respect to certain users of the mail.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're not in that situation. We're not talking about the user of the mail. We're talking about the price of a specific product, and it's not the same thing. The Postal Regulatory Commission has said essentially that users of the mail means a particular product, and I'm not sure that that's true. In any event, the Supreme Court has already interpreted 101D and what it meant under the PRA. This provision was adopted by Congress in 1970 in the Postal Reform Act, not in the PAEA. So the Supreme Court has looked at this, and they've decided what this means. What they have said it means is that it expresses the general policy of Congress that it would be unfair for the users of one class of mail to pay the costs associated with another class of mail. Mm-hmm. So to the extent it means something, it means that you can't have inter-class as opposed to intra-class cross-subsidies. And I think that is what it means. The Supreme Court has said that's what it means, is that it's not fair to impose costs across different types of users of different classes of mail.
But they didn't address this specific issue of whether intra-class subsidies might run afoul of 101D. That just wasn't before them, right?
That's correct. There weren't even products of that.
That language doesn't answer the issue. It shed some light on it, but doesn't answer the question that we have before us, right?
Right. But Congress did when it adopted the specific provisions of Chapter 36, and it said that on the competitive side of products, and these are products where we compete with other companies, that every product must cover its attributable costs. And on the market dominant side, where we don't have competition, it said that we have to cover costs on a class-wide basis. And at the risk of offending Judge Williams, who last week said he doesn't like the cliche, Congress knew, if Congress wanted to do that, it knew how to do it. I think in this situation, that's exactly what's happened. Congress chose to say that products must cover their costs on the competitive side. On the market dominant side, they said something entirely different.
To be more exact here, your argument essentially from 3622C2 and 3633A is that they imply a negative rule that essentially, so long as those criteria are satisfied, that is really the end of the game.
I think that's right, because
the possible exception, I suppose, of some of this, some of the subclauses of 3622B or the other ones in C coming into play.
Correct, but the PRC did not suggest that these rates violate any of those.
It definitely relies on 101D.
Yes, right. And I think
to try to put it as exactly as I can, it's that the choice is between a negative implication of two provisions and the sort of brooding omnipresence of 101D, right? And you say that the negative implications of the two things in Chapter 36 are strong enough to rule out any role for 101D.
Yes, and to use another cliche of statutory construction, the specific controls the general. This 3622 was designed specifically to place limits on pricing.
Specific controls the general, but there's still the question of how specific the specific is. And that maxim doesn't do you any good until you've found the negative implication from those two provisions.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think it's an important negative implication. Congress recognized that there could and would be intra-class cross subsidies when it made that choice. There's no other way to interpret that. If you can have products that don't cover their costs, there will be an intra-class cross subsidy. That Congress, when it chose that language, it recognized the possibility. And the reason that is a possibility and a particular problem that they have to be allowed is, of course, that the Postal Service on the market dominant side has an inflation-based price cap. When you have an inflation-based price cap, you are not guaranteed to be able to cover all of your costs on all of your products because your pricing is capped, especially in low, and this is why we have the situation right now, is in low inflation periods, we don't have a lot of room to raise prices. So as costs go up in the system, there's no way for us to raise prices when inflation is low. Costs have been going up in the system for two reasons. One, the actual cost of things like gas and the things that we use to move the mail have gone up, and two, mail volume has fallen. And with mail volume falling, particularly in this product, the standard flats product, you have to apportion the costs of carrying that mail across a smaller number of pieces. And so as the number of pieces drops, the cost per piece goes up. And that's what Congress recognized when it allowed us to have this pricing flexibility. We weren't going to be able to cover, they knew we weren't going to be able to cover our costs on all of our products in certain circumstances, so it allowed that pricing flexibility. And, Your Honor, to refer back to the to 3622, one of the goals of the PAEA was to allow pricing flexibility for the Postal Service. And with the
3622C7.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. I was wondering about that subsection and also subsections 1 and 8. One talks about the value of the mail service actually provided, each type, so forth. And 8 talks about the relative value to the people of kinds of mail matter. Those sound sort of, but not perhaps exactly, like an endorsement of value of service pricing. And I was wondering that somehow or other that hasn't come up at all in this case, at least in any explicit way.
Well, I think it's fairly clear that the Postal Service can't price based on value of service.
Ramsey pricing is ruled out by this?
I'm sorry?
Ramsey pricing is ruled out by this statute?
I think that we have to follow some of the clear boundaries, which are that each class has to cover its costs.
Right.
And so
that's consistent with Ramsey pricing.
I guess I'm not familiar with that concept, Your Honor.
It's a FERC term.
Okay.
It's much broader than FERC.
I've never done a FERC case. But what I would suggest, Your Honor, with respect to 1 and 8 is that this gets us a little bit into the second argument, which is what is enforceable in the ACD and in the annual compliance determination process. And I think the answer to that is they have to be some of those fairly clear boundaries, and they have to be found in this section. Not all of these are directives to the Postal Service. The whole section...
I mean, I guess, giving you my own intuitive reaction, if 1 and 8 refer to value of service pricing, a technical concept, to be sure, then they're pretty easily applied. If they refer to some loosey-goosey asking how much people like the junk mail they get and so forth, then it's rather different.
I understand, Your Honor, but this whole section starts out with these are directives to the PRC on how to design the rate-making system, and the Postal Regulatory Commission has done that through its regulations, and I assume that it took all these factors into consideration when it designed the system of rate-making. These are not directives to the Postal Service. These are directives to the PRC, and if we are complying with these rules, the clear rules, and the PRC's regulations, it seems to me that we are meeting those objectives, and we are doing, the Postal Service is doing, what it's required to do under the law. I see I'm well into my rebuttal time, and I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, Abby Wright on behalf of the Postal Regulatory Commission. Congress has charged the Commission to serve as a check on the rate-making decisions of the Postal Service and provide a safeguard ensuring that the requirements of the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act have been met. In fulfillment of this responsibility, the Commission's review and its annual compliance determination extends to Section 101D, a key rate-making provision of Title 39. The Commission correctly determined in this case that rates for the standard mail flats product did not comply with Section 101D, which requires that postal rates be established to apportion the cost of all postal operations to all users of the mail on a fair and equitable basis. The persistent and worsening failure of the standard mail flats product to cover its costs to the tune of $1.4 billion over the last 3 years has imposed an interclass subsidy on other users of standard mail products.
The reply brief argues that when you talk about interclass subsidies, you're just talking about a difference in price. let's say, that's a difference in relationship between cost and rate. And so I was wondering if you see any additional meaning in it.
I think the interclass subsidy here is, what we're talking about are attributable costs of a product. So those are volume, yes. They should be volume variable, they should be the incremental costs. And so another product in the standard mail class, that the revenues from that product are going to pay the attributable costs. So we're not even talking about
that follows when, let's confine ourselves to attributable cost, when you have a different ratio between rate and attributable cost, right?
Well, and the problem in this case specifically is that the product is not covering its own attributable
cost.
That's right.
Yes. I'm just trying to get at whether there's anything more than rhetoric in the talk about subsidization.
Well, I think what we have in this case, in the annual compliance determination, is there were commenters who said, we use other standard mail products and we're subsidizing the users of standard mail flats. In many cases, those are direct.
That would be true every time there's a different ratio between the rate and the attributable costs.
Well, I guess for my
point. In fact, it's actually the conditions that make it stronger, but anyway. So.
Where there's a failure to cover the attributable. So there could be a different ratio. The problem is that they're subsidizing the attributable costs of the other product.
Well, it's more of a disparity if there's a disparity limited to the attributable cost. I agree with that. But any such disparity creates some sort of cross-subsidy.
I think, and where it becomes the basis for the Commission's noncompliance determination is Section 101D, and that's about apportioning the costs on a fair and equitable basis. And so the Commission said in this case, because the Postal Service was making no progress towards cost coverage in the last 3 years, and indeed things were getting worse, it wasn't fair and equitable to require the other users of the standard mail products to subsidize those.
The Commission says that it's limiting this 101D override power to extreme cases, but then its remedy is to say that the Postal Service must bring the rates of these items up to full coverage of attributable cost.
Well, I think extreme can have, it could be a measure of the disparity. It can also be a directional measure, and I think the Commission was most troubled in this case. Your Honor, puzzled. That the Postal Service was not moving in the right direction over the last 3 years.
Punished by, in this particular product, going all the way up although presumably long before it got to full coverage, it would be not extreme.
Well, I take issue with the word punished, Your Honor. I think what the Commission asked the Postal Service to do is to implement and develop a plan to move the product towards cost coverage. The Commission's position is that ideally all products will cover their costs. A successful business has revenues from each.
Isn't the remedy here supposed to be until it exceeds its costs?
Until it exceeds, I think they meant cost. The Commission means cost coverage by that. So the revenues are sufficient to cover the attributable cost.
What does exceeds mean?
I think the Commission meant
exceeds by a penny.
What such that it covers.
Do we know at that point whether that's a higher percentage than the other products within the class?
Do we whether cost coverage will be higher in other standard mail?
If this one has to go to 100%, are the other products also already at 100%?
Parcels, the only product that's not is parcels, and that the Postal Service implemented an 11% increase in 2011. They're really moving parcels. They're also doing some work
bringing it up to what fraction of total attributable costs?
We haven't had the annual compliance information for 2011 completed yet, so I'm not sure what that has done in fiscal year 2011.
Well, what was it before they
It was around 80% as well. It was maybe slightly lower than the standard mail flats product, and then prices were raised 11% in 2011.
What do you make of the allusions to the value of service?
These factors are things that the Commission takes into account
what
when it's
it mean?
Reviewing.
I understand that both as objectives in B and factors in C, there's incredible overlap between those. The Commission's supposed to take them into account, but what does it mean?
I'm also not familiar with the concept from FERC, so I'm afraid I may make some misstatement here. But
it's not a FERC.
I think I would take the value of the mail service. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of the nonprofit, that was something that Congress did with nonprofit mail, but that there might be some kinds of mail that have a value to the sender, and that's something that the Postal Service can take into account, the Commission can take into account, the Postal Service can take into account in developing its rates.
Because, I mean, let me suggest something to you, and that is you have the explicit, actually twice, both as an objective and a factor, reference to pricing flexibility, presumably that being for the Postal Service. Mm-hmm. And you have these possible allusions to value of service pricing. And one can well understand Congress thinking that the Postal Service has quite sound incentives to exercise pricing flexibility, if it has it, to adopt value of service pricing where it can, and thereby minimize its losses on the theory that an increase in the price for these items, the flats, will take away more business than a comparable increase in price for the other products.
Is Your Honor contemplating the sort of elasticities of the products,
yes,
how they would respond,
yes,
to the...
Yes.
I think that the Postal Service, I want to emphasize, did not make such an argument to the Commission in,
yes,
defense
of
the
too.
Rates in this case. And the Commission, if such an argument were made, would made in the future, would consider. But the Postal Service simply said in its annual compliance report, you denied our exigent rate request. We can't do anything. This cost coverage problem, it is what it is. They've never articulated.
Well, the argument, what you're saying is the argument that they made in their briefs was not made to the Commission?
They certainly did not. The hypothetical they developed in their brief was not an argument.
Leaving aside the hypothetical.
That's not a value of service argument.
Even the sort of narrative about why they might wish or not want to raise certain prices with,
yeah,
the price cap, they did not make that kind of argument to the Commission.
In your brief, you say, I hope this is your brief, I'm tributing to you, the Postal Service has failed to use its intra-class price flexibility to redress this balance. Not only is the Postal Service losing money that it cannot afford to forgo, but the failure to address this, et cetera. Well, why do you think they're doing this? I mean, their argument is, we understand the economics of the mail. The best thing we can do here is to do it the way we're doing it. Do you have some nefarious idea that they're doing it for some nefarious reason, or they're just stupid, or
no.
What is it?
There's no understanding that there's been any bad faith in this case.
Well, in that case, why not leave it to the, if your concern is about losing money that it cannot afford to forego, and they have exactly the same concern, they're closer to this than the Commission is, why wouldn't the Commission defer to their judgment about which, in light of the elasticities, which products to charge more for?
I think the Commission might defer to that judgment if that judgment had been presented to the Commission in this case. So the Postal Service did not say, we would raise standard mail flats, but we really need to raise the prices on X, Y, or Z. They've never made that kind of argument to the Commission. And so at this point, it's purely speculative in their briefs as to why they would make those decisions and whether the data supports those kinds of decisions. And I would note in there, the exigent rate request was part of their prior plan to raise standard mail flats cost coverage, but it also included a plan to include above average increases in the following years after the exigent rate request. So the Postal Service did seem to be committed to that course and then changed course in their annual compliance report in fiscal year 2010.
What was your answer to their argument that this flats includes the nonprofit and the nonprofit is capped, so it automatically drives the percentage of coverage down?
I think there are two responses. The first is to note that all standard mail products include both the commercial and the nonprofit rate. So that's not something that's particularly hampering the standard mail flats product as opposed to other standard mail products. The second is that, I guess I have three responses. The second is that the commercial flats are also below 90% cost coverage, even taking out the nonprofit commercial flats because there's a smaller, sorry, the nonprofit flats, there's a smaller number of nonprofit flats. So even taking those out, you've still got a significant cost coverage shortfall. And the third response is that when the Postal Service devised its list of products, it specifically considered whether nonprofit and commercial belonged in the same product and determined that there were not distinct cost and market characteristics such that it would divide you know, have a nonprofit and a commercial for every product.
That's a different issue than whether they're being artificially driven down by the fact of the cap on those.
I mean, I think we can't deny that it is being driven down to some extent by the fact that the nonprofit rates have to be 60% of the commercial rates. But in other standard mail products, the Postal Service has been able to achieve cost coverage.
Which is the product that's at 100%?
All the other four, so parcels, setting aside parcels, but the other four are well above 100%.
They all have 200%. They also all have a significant non.
They all profit. Have nonprofit is included in that product as well. Sorry.
Colleagues have no further.
Do you reject the general proposition made by the Postal Service that those two sections, the one explicitly on classes and explicitly on competitive products, do have a negative implication for other interferences with the rates?
I don't think they change the 101D analysis, which is directed at postal rates. And so
you'd say they generally have that implication, but in an extreme case, whatever that may mean, it's overcome by 101D.
I think yes, the commission has a duty to consider 101D and the apportionment of costs and looking at postal rates and determining whether those costs are apportioned.
Well, but the two specific sections mandate that very clearly, right?
When you say it's a 3622C2 referring to classes and then the competitive
right.
products,
right.
I think those are requirements that Section 101D is a fairness and an equitable. The commission is looking at whether something is fair and whether something is equitable, and so they've determined, even in this annual compliance determination, that certain products didn't cover their costs, but because the Postal Service was moving towards cost coverage, there was not non-compliance. Whereas I think with a competitive product.
I think I understand that argument more or less, but I just wanted to make sure I understand what the PRC's position is on the sort of prima facie implication of those two sections.
So I think with the competitive products, if you had a competitive product that was not covering its costs and was therefore being subsidized.
Oh, right.
That would be an immediate non-compliance. Clearly.
But the question is whether there is any kind of negative implication from those specific provisions.
I don't think there's any negative implication
on 101D.
The looking at postal rates. But
since 101D has no real content, that means there's no negative implication at all.
Well, I would disagree with that. It has no real content.
Little cognitive content.
The question before the commission under 101D is whether the apportionment of the attributable costs is fair and equitable. And the commission in this case...
I'm not sure what's left of all the subsections on your reading. Right? Because, I mean, this certainly are... Well, I guess in their explicit mandates, the commission acknowledges they control... But they have no implication otherwise.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. It is C14 is one of the factors. So the policies Congress has directed the commission to consider them as one of these factors. And so there would be, as I said, the Postal Service made an argument that we understand what you're saying about Section 101D, but for other factors, other objectives point perhaps in the other direction. They've not done so here.
Incidentally, couldn't 101D operate in the context of the specific rules simply as a guide to interpretation of ambiguous provisions?
I think that Section 101D, I mean, Congress left, it predated the PAA, but Congress knew it was there.
Right.
And has ongoing, and in the complaint process.
But I'm suggesting a possible function for it less drastic than that the commission assigns to it.
I would point to 3662, which is the complaint process, which specifically states that Section 101D is the basis for a complaint.
No, I think so that's perhaps your
I think Congress knew about 101D, and there would be no basis for Congress to have placed that in the complaint proceeding unless it had independent force of its own.
Yes.
Well, I guess it could mean you have a statute with umpty-ump factors, and in the end, something has to override all those factors and sort of provide an overlay over all the 14 or more factors.
With respect to the complaint?
Yeah, and that fair and equitable in the end is sort of a generalized thing that the commission's supposed to be taking into consideration with respect to how it weighs all these different factors.
Congress included 101D and several other provisions and then Chapter 36 as well in the complaint proceeding, so I think it does indicate that Congress saw them as operating somewhat independently.
Further questions? Okay. We have the
no further
Thank
questions.
You.
We ask that the should be denied. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear again from Mr. Elston. Does he have time? There you go. You heard how liberal we are with minutes here.
Yes.
Before you even start, how do you handle 3662, which doesn't appear in either of your briefs?
3662.
The one on complaints, which complaints to enforce 101D.
Right. And, of course, this is not a complaint proceeding. This is
I understand that.
I will answer that by saying this. There are situations where 101D could come into play, where the Postal Service could adopt rates that are not fair and equitable. And let me give you an example of that. Let's say that first-class mail, we decided that we were going to put all of our increases, let's say inflation went up, and we decided we were going to put all of our increases on first-class mail. We were going to leave rates for the others alone because we don't want to drive out business or we want to favor business mail. And we put all of the increases on that legally within the price cap, within all the other specific requirements. And all of a sudden, first-class mail was covering almost all of the excess costs of the Postal Service, not the costs of the specific thing, but institutional costs. That would be, I think, an unfair and inequitable situation. And I think that's the kind of thing that one
even, regardless of whether it violated 3633A.
We would, well, that would, if it were legal under all the specific provisions of Chapter 36. That's what I guess I'm suggesting.
Okay, that's your.
If we were doing it legally with that whole Chapter 36, but nonetheless, we were covering all of our institutional costs on one class of mail, essentially, I think that that would be unfair and inequitable. And that's, if you want to look at 103.
It sounds like just another extreme case.
No, if you want to look at, well, I would call 101D a catch-all. If there's a real problem, something that was, sort of beyond the pale, I guess. But that's not what we have here.
Then you and the commissioner are quibbling about the difference between extreme and beyond the pale.
No, maybe that's right, Your Honor, but I guess I can envision that situation. Let me just quickly say that Ramsey pricing has, now that I figured out what it is, thanks to Mr. German, has been ruled out by the Postal Rate Commission early on in the PRA era. And I'm going to give you a 28J letter with a citation to that that explains that. And those provisions are left over from the PRA, but they don't mean what maybe you thought they meant, at least in this context.
Can I ask you now? With respect to the government's argument, I shouldn't say the government, the
other government.
The other government's argument, the Justice Department's argument, that your principal argument here was not raised below. What do you say about that? And if could you point me to what page you make the argument that in light of cross elasticities, in light of the lower volume, in light of the greater volume, we know how to make money, don't bother us. Where is that argument made?
Well, Your Honor, our principal argument is that we don't have to do that, that in this situation, pricing flexibility belongs to the Postal Service, that in this context, we don't have to justify...
Other than the argument that you're not reviewable at all.
Pardon me?
The specific argument that you did spend a lot of time in the briefs and that you spent some amount of time in oral argument, is that... You concede that's not raised below?
The third argument in terms of how you do this could hurt the Postal Service financially?
Yes.
That argument...
Or that we've done the best we can
sure.
In light of the fact, in light of the actual economics.
Well, we haven't actually made that argument, and I don't think that we have enough in the record to make that argument. The reason it's not, again, is because we don't think we have to justify that to the Postal Regulatory Commission. We think we have the flexibility to make those judgments. But I would say, Your Honor, that the American Catalog Mailers Association raised this argument. And if you're going to get into all these general policies, and it's the PRC's duty under the ACD provision to consider all of those factors. They have an independent duty to determine whether the rates are not in compliance with the applicable provisions of this chapter. And well, if you're going to start...
That's true of lots of agencies, but usually we require somebody to raise an argument to them so they know what they should be considering.
I think it was adequately raised by the American Catalog Mailers Association, who was a party below, at least in the way the PRC views parties. And they said precisely this, that if you raise the rates of a declining product at the expense of a product that's increasing, you may actually achieve less contribution, less revenue to cover the Postal Service's institutional costs.
The Postal Service doesn't say that's why we did it this way here.
No, but again, our principal argument is that we don't have to do that because we have flexibility. And I think that takes me to a point that's very important. The Postal Service, of course, would love it if we could have every product cover its costs. We have no interest in having lots of products underwater like we do. We'd be better off if we didn't. But we have to make tough choices in a price cap regime.
Don't you have to explain the tough choices to the commission so that they know? I mean, what if your reason was, I don't know, we got bigger campaign contributions from product X than product Y, and you just don't say anything. And the other side says, well, there's no explanation for this in terms of economics. You can just stay mute?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor, but this is an iterative process with the Postal Regulatory Commission. They have the authority to ask us questions. They approved rates not only on this product but on other products that were below this level of cost coverage in previous years. And so I think it's incumbent on the PRC to say, look, we are actually thinking that this now, even though it didn't violate 101D last year or the year before, now we think it does violate 101D, and we want you to explain yourselves. And that didn't happen.
Did you make the argument about 101D below, that it was improper for them to rely on 101D?
I don't believe so, because I think the year before they indicated that Standard Flats was in jeopardy of violating a provision of Chapter 36, which was...
You had a chance for...
Just and reasonable rate schedule. Uh-huh. And they didn't choose that. They didn't choose that rationale when they issued their annual compliance
report. The reply comments that you filed, which were after the annual compliance report, right? Mm-hmm. If you thought that they misinterpreted the statute with respect to 101D, that would be the place for you to argue that so that they could say, oh, my God, you're right, rather than wait until now. That's not in there either, is it? Or is it? I don't know. Maybe it is.
I'm not sure. I'll have to
I couldn't look. Find it.
I'll take your word for it, Your Honor. But
then doesn't that waive? I mean, if you're challenging the basis of the argument, most of the oral argument was that 101D is not appropriate for them to rely on, don't you waive that argument by not raising it before the commission?
Judge, I'm fairly certain that... we did say that this rate doesn't violate the statute. The statute, in our interpretation year in and year out with Postal Regulatory Commission, is that products on the market dominant side need not cover their costs. In fact, the Postal Regulatory Commission has approved product after product after product as being consistent with all of the provisions of Chapter 36 year in and year out, even though those products do not cover their costs. So to the extent that we didn't reiterate what's been a longstanding interpretation of the Postal Service and the PRC, that market-dominant products need not cover their costs, and there were no substantive limitations on the low end of that, like excessiveness or deepening and continuing, those are all things that were made up in the annual compliance determination. They're not things that are in any statute or regulation that I'm aware of. And so in order to fight off those arguments, we would have had to have been a little bit clairvoyant. Our point is that the statute doesn't say there's a limit on how far a product can be underwater. It says the Postal Service has pricing flexibility. Now, that said, I want to be clear, the Postal Service is not in favor of having products that cover only 20% of their costs. That's not what we're going after. But in a price-capped environment, we have to make difficult choices about especially in a low-inflation environment, about where to place our price increases. And the statute gives the Postal Service that flexibility. It's explicit. We are to have pricing flexibility within these general, these specific bright line rules that cabin our discretion. And so I think it would have been difficult for us to have guessed that the PRC was going to usurp that authority and take away our pricing flexibility. It's an odd kind of flexibility, Judge, for the PRC to say, year in and year out, we've suggested to you that you use your pricing flexibility to achieve greater cost coverage of standard flats. And then if we don't do that, we're going to make you do it anyway. Well, what kind of flexibility is that? That's, I think, not what Congress had in mind, and that's why we're here, is they said, you have this flexibility. And we said, thank you very much. We're not going to use it that way.
You had 3 years to use the flexibility, and you didn't. They got tired, right?
But again, if it's flexibility, why do we have to use it that way? And that's the point, is that the Postal Service has the flexibility to make those judgments within certain specific rules, and certainly...
So you're, just to be clear, then, your view is that if, as long as it's within... class, you don't have to have an explanation. There's no cognate of arbitrary and capricious review by the agency. The agency, you can, even if it were completely clear that you're making wrong decisions with respect to the economic explanation you're giving, the commission would have no authority to say that's unfair and inequitable?
Your Honor, I would say that in an iterative process, they could have asked us that question. They could have said, why, Postal Service, are you doing this?
Is your position that, that you don't have to answer them?
No, that's not. We would answer that question, certainly. But I'm not sure.
And would they have to accept your answer, whatever you said? Is that your position?
I think at the end of the day, Your Honor, that's correct, because this is an area that the statute has given to the Postal Service. The statute has divided responsibility between these two government agencies. The PRC has a lot of authority. There's no doubt about that. But the Postal Service got something out of the PAEA too, and that's this pricing flexibility. And if we're capped at the top by a strict price cap, and that's what the Postal Regulatory Commission told us in the exigent rate case, which this court decided last year in terms of whether we could have an exigent rate increase, and that's where we were trying to fix the problem of underwater products. They denied it. So we've got a very rigid price cap at the top end, and we've got other limitations like the work share discount and things that are very clear in terms of our pricing flexibility. Where the statute doesn't have something that limits our pricing flexibility, it seems to me that that is an area that's been reserved to the Postal Service. Okay, I'm not saying, sorry.
I have that argument, and 2 minutes has greatly expanded.
But my colleagues have questions. Unfortunately, I have a question.
Nope. The clock does not govern my colleagues.
Thank goodness.
Suppose there is a complaint under 3662, putting aside the question of what 101D means in that context. Would the ruling be binding on all future Postal Service rate decisions with respect to that product? And if not, why not? I mean, as a practical matter, wouldn't it be? Because other complainers could come forward and win on the basis of the first complaint.
Right. I think that if we lost a complaint proceeding and we either decided not to appeal it or we appealed it and lost as well, that would certainly be binding on us in the future. We would treat it as binding whether it was legally or not. There wouldn't be any point to us.
The most you can get from us is a decision that in this particular context, the commission can't apply the 101D.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because, again, I think that that the concept of apportioning costs among the users of the mail is not the same as whether individual products on the market-dominant side need to cover their costs, and that's what they have equated, those two things. This court, I think, in this case, can rule that there's not a downward limitation on our on losing products. I mean, there are limitations, like we don't want to have products that lose money that would prevent us from doing that.
Let me reframe my question then. You're really asking us for an interpretation of the whole statute, including 101D, which reads it as at least giving, how shall I put it? It gives effect to your negative implication from the two sections we've talked about, up to the point where, and perhaps you should state it again, the beyond the pale situation.
Your Honor, I think that there would have to be, if we are complying with every regulation and every provision of Chapter 36, I will amend my statement. I don't think we can be violating 101D because if we have a just and reasonable rate schedule, and that's I think a question Your Honor should ask, is if this rate schedule is just and reasonable as the PRC found, how can it be unfair and inequitable? It seems to me that those things are not entirely consistent. And
well,
so
don't we owe, to somebody use the magic word at the end of the argument, Chevron deference to the PRC? Haven't we said that?
I don't think you say that in the context of a plain meaning argument. I don't know that they've made an interpretation of 101D.
Well, that's because you didn't raise 101D before them, so that does make it. They have certainly said what they think 101D means. They relied on it, and they relied on the fact that it applies in this case. For us to go with you, we would have to either decide that it unambiguously doesn't apply in this case, or that they've unreasonably applied it in this case, correct?
That's correct, and I think that you look to the specific statutes that talk about cost coverage of classes in the, on the market dominant side and cost coverage of
but
products.
The opposing counsel points out there is one of the, I think it's number 14, which says apply the rest of the policies too.
Which of course doesn't make sense because then it would just, why would you say this chapter? Why wouldn't you say this title?
They have an argument about that as well, casting back to another section that in the chapter that then casts back to the other section.
But the same section that gives them the authority to enforce the policies of this chapter says that the general policies of this title they can make recommendations on. So if Congress says you can enforce these provisions of this chapter, but the rest of the title, the general provisions of the title, you can make recommendations, doesn't that suggest that that's a limit on their authority?
Your position is that it's not only suggests, but that it's unambiguous. That has to be your position, is that right?
That is our position, and I think it's correct. And Judge, I'm sorry that I'm taking so much time, but you said you know what 101.
The people in the back.
You know what 101D means, but I don't know what 101D means.
Well, that's pretty ambiguous, also.
And
then that obviously fair and equitable are sort of one of the obvious sets of words that are ambiguous, and that we defer to the agency.
But where are we in compliance? 85%, 87%, 93%, 97%? I don't know. They said that we have to bring it to exceed its cost coverage, and that to me means that market dominant products have to cover their costs. In their view, in the PRC's view, market dominant products have to cover their costs. That is absolutely contrary to the statute, which says market dominant products need only cover their costs as a class. And with that, Your Honor, I'd ask you to set aside the PRC's decision. Thank you.
We have the argument. We'll take a brief break while people play musical chairs.